Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Wednesday, March 4th, and we have a full day, so let's go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 279. Would you remind us what that bill is? And Chip, if you help for a second.
Actually, I'll be voting now. I'll just move it.
Thank you.
I suppose I can still move it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 279 establishes the Oregon Medical Board as a semi-independent state agency. It changed the selection of board member candidates. It directs the legislative fiscal officer to submit the board's adopted budget to Joint Committee on Ways and Means, which may require the board to appear at a hearing to request amendments. It abolishes the board account and transfers the balance to an account established by the board to be appropriated by the board, and it creates an operative date of July 1st, 2015. There are no amendments and no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued.
Okay, I have to close the work session on Senate Bill 279 at this point in time and open a work session on Senate Bill 144, and we have the Dash 2 amendments. Could you bring us up to date?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 144 requires a health benefit plan to provide video conferencing if it is safely and effectively provided according to generally accepted healthcare practices and technology that meet state and federal laws on privacy and security. It removes the requirement that a health plan must provide coverage if health services do not duplicate or supplant a health service available to the patient in person. It specifies that coverage is subject to reimbursement specified in the contract between the plan and health professional. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a Dash 2 amendment which applies an effective date for health benefit plans issued or renewed on or after January 1st, 2016. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. We have the Dash 2 amendments that have been okayed by the work group that worked on this during the interim on telemedicine. Do I have a motion to adopt the Dash 2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 144.
Senator Shields moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 144. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 144 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves Senate Bill 144 to the floor with the Dash 2 amendments. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Excused.
Chair Mona Anderson?
Aye, and I will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 144 in just 1 second here. I will reopen the work session on Senate Bill 279. It's already been explained to us. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Apologies. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 279 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 279 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator,
aye.
Senator Shields?
Nope.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Excused.
Chair Mona Anderson?
Aye. And Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That I will close the work session on 279, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 147. And the reason I'm going with 147, I believe there are children here. 4147, are you here for 147? Yes. So that's why so that the kids can leave if they want to leave a little early. Okay, Zena.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 147 broadens prescription substitution requirements from biosimilar to biological products. It prohibits the substitution of biological products by pharmacy or pharmacist unless the name and manufacturer of the product is communicating to the dispensing practitioner. It specifies that communication is not required if the prescription is a refill and the biological product is the same as last time it was refilled. It requires the board to adopt rules defining biological product. There is a Dash 1 amendment, and there's no revenue impact, and this fiscal statement hasn't been issued.
Okay. So I'm not sure who wants to start this off. Is it Barbara Flynn? Who wants to go first? Oh, Jim McKay should go first. Okay. And then Barbara Flynn and Anna Marie Meyer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jim McKay. I'm a director of clinical development at Sandoz. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 147 as amended. Passage of Senate Bill 147 will promote timely market entry for interchangeable biologic products. These are high quality, competitively priced alternatives to existing biologics that offer patients and payers in Oregon and other states in the country the prospect of substantial savings and increased access to these important medicines. Sandoz is a generic pharmaceuticals division of Novartis. We are the world leaders in developing and manufacturing and commercializing biosimilars. We have greater than 50% market share in highly regulated markets around the world in the biosimilars market. We have biosimilars approved in over 50 countries around the world, and to date we have generated about 200 million patient days of exposure to our biosimilars. We are committed to increasing access to these critical medicines for patients in Oregon and across the U.S., just as we have done in other countries around the world. For example, the use of a biologic medicine to prevent infections in cancer patients by boosting white blood cell count increased by about 30% when biosimilars were introduced into the market in Europe. This was due to the introduction of biosimilar competition and demonstrates that more patients receive this critical medication, yet overall costs to the healthcare system actually decreased for this particular drug. Sandoz and its parent company, Novartis, together with several other key organizations with extensive experience in the manufacturing and sale of biosimilars, support the introduction of equitable, consistent, and pro-competitive state-level legislation that paves the way for automatic substitution of future interchangeable biologics. And Senate Bill 147 is a reflection of this pragmatic approach because it involves an identical approach to all biologics, including biosimilars. It also takes into account that the fact that many prescribing physicians may actually prefer this type of communication until they have seen how the interchangeable biosimilar market evolves in practice. Without this pragmatic approach, we're concerned that more restrictive proposed legislation could hinder biosimilar uptake. Now, Sandoz actively opposed legislation in several states in 2013, including in Oregon. That legislation included provisions for mandatory prescriber notification and onerous patient notification requirements because the language did not provide a level playing field for all biologics, including biosimilars. The approach we now support does do just that, and we therefore see it as a positive pro-competitive development and a pro-competitive change in the legislation. And I'll just add here at this point that the GPHA, which is our trade association, also has provided a letter of support for this bill, and it's listed in the OLIS that's in front of you, as well as the Oregon Medical Association has provided a letter in support of this legislation. The approach outlined in Senate Bill 147 relies on the growing adoption of interoperable electronic health and prescription records that allow for complete medical record for patients. Communication would only occur when there is no electronic health or prescription record in place, and the pharmacist could use any means available to communicate to the physician who wrote the prescription. This communication would occur whether an original biologic or the interchangeable biologic is dispensed, ensuring a complete medical record and, importantly, also providing a level pro-competitive playing field for all biologics. I appreciate your time and attention and patience on this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Let's do the panel first, and then I'm going to have to, because there are so many people signed up for this bill, to limit you to 3 minutes apiece. So please go forward. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Anna Marie Meyer. I'm a single mom. I was born in Laurelhurst and now live in Happy Valley. The legislatures that serve my community are Senator Alan Olson and Representative Bill Kenemer. I'm here today representing myself. Creaky Joints, an arthritis support organization, which is part of the Global Healthy Living Foundation, and other people in Oregon who are or who will be taking biologics and biosimilars. I have taken biologics and had adverse reactions to them, as well as to other drugs, including antibiotics. I am here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 147. More specifically, I support the notification requirements Senate Bill 147 contains. If physicians had not known exactly what drug I was taking, including the name of my biologics, when I had a severe adverse reaction, I could have died. Both I and the retreatment team taking care of me knew every drug I was taking and considered these drugs when they were saving my life. So as you can see, in my mind, this is not an argument reserved for corporations, their products, profits, or interests. It is an argument about people and what information we need in order to feel better, to control our chronic illness, and to stay alive when the worst happens. I want to be very clear when I say that I am here. I am not here to talk about whether biosimilars should or should not be on the market, or whether insurance companies should be able to influence what drug a patient takes. If a drug is approved by the FDA, I assume it is safe and effective. If my insurance company wants to switch a drug that the FDA says it can switch, I trust the FDA's decision and will take that drug. I am only asking that I and my doctor know what drug that is. I knew what drugs I was taking, my doctors knew what drugs I was taking, and that information helped save my life when I had allergic reactions. This is the first time I have spoken to legislatures. It is very intimidating, but it is very important. As I look around the room, I see people here who are dressed better than I am and who may speak better than I do, making a living speaking to legislatures across the country. I'm not one of those people. I'm an Oregon citizen who is alive today because my doctor and I knew what drugs I was taking. As patients, we don't want to give that up. And as compassionate legislatures, you can't let that happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Fly, and I'm here on behalf of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, which, as you may know, is the public policy and advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. We urge your support of Senate Bill 147 because it specifically requires patient and provider notification if a substitution is made. The development of biologic drugs has provided cancer patients and their physicians with access to improved therapeutic options, just as generics have done for small molecule drugs. Interchangeable biosimilars have the potential to increase price competition on older biologic drugs and result in lower cost burdens for cancer patients. As biosimilar policies are developed, they must focus on ensuring the safety and efficacy of all biologic drugs, whether they're the innovator drug or they are the biosimilar drug. And policies must also ensure access and affordability of biosimilars for cancer patients. The FDA requires robust evidence, providing sufficient evidence in terms of safety and efficacy between biologics and those deemed as interchangeable biosimilars. Even so, biologics are manufactured in living organisms and are therefore much more complex than manufacturing pharmaceutical generics. In addition, biosimilars are not exact replications of their reference biologic product, and as such, a patient's response may be different to the substituted product. Given the complexity of cancer treatments for complexity of treatments for cancer patients, these minor differences could result in significant complications that would not be readily understood if not both the patient and the provider knew about the substitution. We urge your support of Senate Bill 147, and specifically because it includes the patient and provider notification provision. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, stay put, because I want to, first of all, commend you for coming, because it's not easy. I remember vividly the first time I came and testified long before I was a legislator, and I was a doctor, and I was scared out of my gourd. I actually think you made the point that I was going to make, and I want to thank you for that, which is to say that as a physician, my concern is why should this just apply to biologics, right? And we know that even though for other generics they're considered bioequivalent, that the carriers, the fillers, whatever that they use to make the drug, the inactive quote-unquote agreements, people can have different responses to. And my concern is that by limiting this to biologics, we imply that it doesn't really matter which generic of another drug you get, they're all equal and you're going to have the same response to them. And as a physician, I'm not convinced that that's true. And when I heard about this bill, my hope was that actually, instead of turning this back to being just about biologics, that we actually looked at ways to have bidirectional communication, electronic communication, so that when my patients get prescriptions filled, I know that they actually filled their prescription, because noncompliance is a huge issue, and also that I knew which brand they got, which lot number, so that if they had an adverse reaction, I could tell whether it was the brand or something, if they got their brand switched, right? So I guess I would ask, not necessarily you, ma'am, because I'm not expecting you, but those of you who are advocating for this on in specific about the biologics, what's the argument for just doing this for biologics instead of asking all of our pharmacies and our electronic health record providers to figure out ways where we can really do true bidirectional communication to enhance patient safety and ensure compliance with medication? And I don't expect you, ma'am, but I thank you for bringing up the point.
I was a critical care nurse my whole life.
Well, there you go. So. See?
But I almost died from Ed Stephen Johnson reaction, and yeah. Almost had a heart attack from one of the
that's bad
for rheumatoid. Uh-huh. And well, I agree that it should be other drugs too, but I think we're just trying to get this ball rolling because mm-hmm. the drugs are so cancer drugs and
sure. No, I understand the implications.
About $8,000 cash for some of my meds.
Believe me, I know.
So
yes.
You can answer better, probably.
Well, I'll just say that I think we're moving in that direction towards bidirectional electronic prescription records and health records. So I think that will be a reality in the not-too-distant future. We do have an expert from Express Scripts that will address some more details around that. So if you ask her that same question, she could probably give you a better answer.
Okay. Thank you.
And the one question I have is why can't a physician or any provider just write on the script or electronically convey "do not substitute"?
And that will always be an option, or remain an option under this bill as well. However, that's not a guarantee that the medical record of the patient will be updated. So we think the language in the bill guarantees that the health record of the patient will be updated once a prescription is filled, but writing "do not substitute" really doesn't guarantee that. However, that's always an option, so the prescriber can guarantee what drug the patient gets.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you so much, panel. I'd like to call Joanna Lindsay, George Ross, and Joy Ross.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of the Arthritis Foundation. My name is Joanna Lindsay, and I'm staff with the Great West Region of the Foundation. Our region serves 782,000 adults here in Oregon with arthritis and 3,400 kids who have arthritis. For our constituents, as we heard earlier, biologics are a life-changing medication. They make the difference between full participation in civic life and disability. But they're costly and they can be hard to access, and we think that the biosimilars have the potential to increase access for the people who do not right now. But we do have some concerns about them, and this bill addresses one of the main ones, which is the physician communication. These drugs are complex, and the diseases themselves are complex. There can be variations from patient to patient and even between batch to batch of the current biologics. We've had families tell us at our camp programs that they've had reactions to the fillers in them, to the preservatives, and even just batch to batch based on their immune system. So they can be, there can be variations already. So it's a little different from the generics in that there is that greater variability. You're going to hear a little bit more from some of our volunteers about their concerns. But what we're hearing is that the doctors want to know, the rheumatologists want to know. I think that in the OLA system, you've heard from the Coalition of State Rheumatology Organizations and from the Oregon Medical Association. The patients want to know, and they've had a pretty simple question. Why wouldn't my doctor be informed about the specific medication that's been dispensed? And the parents of kids with juvenile arthritis want to know, and they want to know, how will my child's doctor know what medication my kid is taking if there's an urgent emergency, and what are the long-term side effects for those kids, and how will we track those? Overall, our goal is to provide surety to the doctors that allows them to permit substitution of the biosimilar so that we do have greater access, but we also don't want to frighten the physicians or the patients. So the notification component is really important. So we support this bill and ask you to focus on the patient protections that communication provides.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is George Ross. I'm here with my family, my wife Joy, my two daughters Isabella and Georgiana, and I'm here to talk to you as a husband and a father. Biologics actually have shaped our life. My wife was diagnosed at age 3 with rheumatoid arthritis. It's actually what took her sight, with a rare form called uveitis. Actually, both my daughters were diagnosed with the same disease. Over the last 12 years, these drugs have really changed the outcome and the prognosis for my children. Today, they're sitting there at 12 and 9 and are practically symptom-free from the arthritis, but it's through these drugs. And just to let you know, kind of as a caregiver, kind of the complexity of what happens in some of these some families like ours. At one point, I was giving up to 6 shots across 3 different prescriptions because they were all having active arthritis flare at the same time. And understanding what I'm giving, who am I giving to, and what the impact of those, and to be able to communicate with my daughter, my physicians, is extremely important. And so for us, it's not about cost. Cost savings. It's about saving quality of life, providing a brighter future for our children. And we work with our physician as a team, and they're intimately involved with the care of our children. And to what Joanna was saying about batch-to-batch difference, with Isabella, she recently got put back on Enbrel this year. And even between batches, we noticed different site reactions in terms of the amount of swelling she has from same manufacturer batch to batch. And so being able to know exactly what we have and being able to communicate with our physicians effectively about that is huge for us.
Thank you.
Joy, do you want anything?
Joy, do you want to speak?
Everything that he has said is exactly same thing I feel, 100%. We're a good team, yeah.
Just say your name for the record.
My name is Joy Ross.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You have a beautiful family.
Thank you.
All right. And no questions? Okay, thank you so much. Let's, Dennis McNanny, B.J. Kavnor, and... is it Mara Farsi? Oh, they can come together. Okay. How about Barbara Hopkins? Please begin.
Go ahead. Chick-fil-A.
No one wants to follow that last panel, I think.
I
for the record, my name's Dennis McNanny, and this is not my normal voice. Puberty is about to break at any moment, I think. I represent the Oregon Bioscience Association. Many of my member companies are involved with this issue. We're here to support the Senate Bill 147 with its Dash 1 amendments. I'm not sure what I can add scientifically or even emotionally to what you've heard so far, but what I know for a fact is that the industry is much more aligned this time around, and it appears that the time is ripe to make progress on this issue. I think for the most of the points that were made earlier about knowing what drugs you're on, having an accurate clinical record, actually harkens back to my previous career in EMR software and surgical software. And even then, in 2006, when the last revisions were made, or at least the most significant revisions were made for the Prescribing Act, it speaks to your frustration, Senator Steiner-Hayward. It shouldn't take 8 years to get a bidirectional transaction going. We've been doing bidirectional transactions in almost every other healthcare transaction for 8 years. And anytime you want any sort of involvement in a working group on that particular topic, I can bring some actual skills and advice to that. It would change everything. In a state so committed to evidence-based medicine, we're working without a lot of evidence in some cases, and I think this is a really great first step. I can't think of a more important class of drugs to have this sort of information available for the reasons that were spoken about earlier. So we're not only supportive of the bill as written, but also the goal someday of having a complete medical record in that respect. There's other testimony I'll check in, but it really mirrors most of what you've heard so far. So in deference to my other panelists, I'll stop here and take any questions when we're complete.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is BJ Kavnor. I'm the Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a chronic health care collaborative in Oregon. And for the record, the cane is for osteoarthritis, because I played too much rugby in my youth. We are wholly in support of this bill. We think that this will have a great impact on affordability of health care for many, many patients in Oregon. We are also greatly concerned, as other people have said, about the ability to have patient notification prior to dispensation, and also provider notification in time in case there are any conditions or any concerns. Simply, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the pharmacy lady.
Hi, my name's Barbara Hopkins, and I live here in Salem, and I have an autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and I have been treated with a rheumatologist, Dr. Callis, since 2012. I started out with chemo pills and NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. With each drug, added blood work done to determine the effect on my liver and inflammation levels. I've worked my way through the non-biological treatments. Some drugs did nothing to relieve the pain or inflammation. Others were toxic to my liver or my eyes. I started on a biologic drug called Humira. After the insurance approved it, it cost about $1,500 of treatment. I was lucky. I have a great quality comprehensive insurance policy. Providence has its own specialty mail order pharmacy. All the specialty tier drugs are delivered from Portland through the Providence Specialty Pharmacy. Unfortunately, Humira had side effects and toxic to my eyes, so I can't take that drug anymore. My next biologic was an infusion chemo Rituxan, which is $14,000 of treatment. Now it's not working for me, so my next drug will be Orencia, and that'll be about $3,000 of treatment. I'm glad the biosimilars will be approved shortly. There's a biosimilar. I looked it up. There's about four or five that might be possibilities for me. It may give me some other treatment options. I take over 21 prescriptions and over-the-counter medicine. I carry a list with me of all the drugs and update those. A lot of the drugs are not prescription. They're over-the-counter. If I have a reaction or they just, they're not prescription. The specialty pharmacy does not know every drug I take. They don't have the list of the side effects, and they don't list my allergy. My doctor needs to know what drugs I'm taking. I need to know what drugs I'm taking, because if I have a reaction, need to use an EpiPen. I don't want, if I'm given a penicillin, I don't want to be substituted with a needle syringe. I'm not capable or not willing to give myself a shot with that. So I need to know what thing and have that option. Biosimilars offer great hope. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Any questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much. And your show and tell has a great impact.
All right, let's go with Elise Brown. Is it Robert Judd, Tom Holt, and then Cindy Laubacher?
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Elise Brown for AHIP. AHIP is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And let me first start by thanking those who have come before us with horrible chronic conditions. A personal story of myself, my sister-in-law has just been diagnosed with MS and primary progressive, so the worst sentence you can get. So I'm very sensitive to the testimony that we just heard, and I wanted to say that. And we are here in opposition to Senate Bill 147, and I think while the bill is well-intended, the reason that we are in opposition is because of the notification requirements would do just the opposite of, I think, the concerns that we heard in support. One thing that the bill will do is block lower cost options, so that's the biosimilars that we heard, to the highest cost drugs, the biologic, and it's going to come at the expense of those who depend on those medications, the chronically ill patients we just heard. As a reminder, Senate Bill 147 is premature. The FDA, which we know has jurisdiction for approving all drugs, has yet to determine which standards will be required for biosimilars to meet the threshold of interchangeability. So we have to ask the question, why would we act before the standards are clear? Senate Bill 147, again, because of unintended consequences, is going to increase cost for consumers and for employers, because it's going to limit patient access to the cheaper drugs. Yet those drugs are quite a bit cheaper than their expensive counterparts. So just as an example, a recent study from RAND finds biosimilars and interchangeable biologics expected to save as much as $66 billion in direct spending on biologic drugs from 2014 to 2024. Shouldn't the consumers have a choice between lower cost and high cost? That's the question. As I mentioned, we have some issues on the notification requirements in Senate Bill 147, and I'd love to have my AHIP member from MOTA walk through those issues.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Robert Judge. I'm the pharmacy director for MOTA Health. MOTA Health is a Northwest-based insurer offering medical, dental, and pharmacy insurance services. We cover roughly 160,000 state employees, under the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, as well as another 230,000 members who have access to that program's drug discount card program, in addition to our other insurance services in the state. We're opposed to Senate Bill 147, as it would make it more difficult for these lower-cost biosimilar agents, as they become available in the market, to be substituted by a pharmacist. We don't think the legislation is in the interest of consumers, of pharmacists, of employers, and insurers who actually underwrite the cost of these drugs in the marketplace. Our opposition falls along five major lines. The first, as was touched on earlier, Senate Bill 147 is premature and unnecessary at this time, since the FDA is still in the process of defining its approval pathways for biosimilar agents. Implementing this legislation now, before those rules are in place, could result in unnecessary conflict between what Oregon's standard is and what the national standard is that the FDA will create. The second, Senate Bill 147 would interfere with lower cost access to treatments, and we've heard from the panels today just how critical biosimilar agents promise to be in helping people with these very difficult conditions manage their conditions, but in a more cost-effective way. Biologics are expensive, hugely expensive. Biosimilar agents offer a promise to reduce those costs by as much as 25% when they become available in the marketplace. But by putting these conditions in this legislation, putting them forward, it's going to make it more difficult for consumers to be able to get access to these drugs by creating artificial hurdles to the substitution capabilities that would be possible. Senate Bill 147 would unnecessarily change the communication requirements for a pharmacy or a pharmacist who substitutes biological product and would significantly increase the hurdles that would need to be overcome by the pharmacist as they substitute to a biosimilar agent. This attempt would represent really a disservice to the patients who could benefit from these lower cost agents. And finally, Senate Bill 147 adds additional regulations that just are not necessary at this point in time. There's a statute already in place that sunsets, but it was put in there temporarily to manage the biosimilar agents passed last year as an interim step as the FDA finalizes its interchangeable pathways, which are expected this year. It's very important to understand there are no biosimilar agents approved for distribution in the United States yet. And those are being held up as the FDA develops their pathways for interchangeability and approve these agents as they come through. Those agents must meet clinical standards for clinical efficacy relative to the agents to which they're similar to before they come to market. So there's work that needs to be done that the FDA has a panel, working on that will be completed this year. So having this legislation come out and really have the potential to conflict with what the feds are doing, I think, creates confusion that the marketplace just does not need in this state. And for these reasons, we're opposed to this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. One of our roles, or key roles, as a health plan is to help our members connect with effective and lowest cost, high quality care in every respect. And throughout the healthcare system, we put not just we, but others in healthcare put barriers in place to encourage people to take a good path versus a less productive path. For example, we have surgical checklists in hospitals so that serious medical errors are avoided, like surgery in the wrong spot. We have a barrier in place in that it's not supposed to happen that someone have surgery without having that checklist so that people do the right thing. This bill is about barriers. And what it would do is erect barriers to the dispensing of lower cost, effective treatments for the most part, conditions that are complex. These products that are in the market today in the biologic space tend to be hideously expensive. We've had lots of discussion in this body about Hep C treatment, for example. So if this bill passed, then there would be barriers to lower cost Hep C treatments when they come to market. The FDA is communicating that it is developing what is going to be a very, very rigorous process to determine what is going to be interchangeable. And our view is that we ought to rely on the FDA for that judgment rather than us here try to play mini FDA. The practical effect of a bill like this, from our point of view, is that it would impede access to lower cost, effective treatments for consumers at great cost to them out of pocket. When we're talking about products that cost thousands of dollars, the out of pocket share is hundreds or even thousands of dollars for a person at a time. What the bill would do is protect the market share of the higher cost first entrance to the market, and it would it just would be a barrier to care that people should be able to benefit from at a lower cost. And our view is this body as a whole should be supporting broad access to effective, lowest cost, high quality care at every opportunity. This bill doesn't do it and should not move forward in our view.
Just one question. I'm still on this do not substitute. If a physician does write a prescription for these biologics and then puts do not substitute, you would still pay for it, correct? Even though it wasn't the lowest cost.
Yes, that's correct. We have, and I'm going to speak on behalf of most insurers because they follow the same or similar processes. Typically, there are various codes that a prescriber can write for. One of those is a dispensed as written code. And when that's written, that's the agent that gets dispensed by the pharmacist, and that's the agent that the pharmacy, that the insurer pays for.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. And Cindy Laubacher, I think you're the last for the opponents.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy Laubacher with Express Scripts here in support of Senate Bill 147. I'm here today specifically to speak to the issue of communication, which is really at the heart of the discussion here, around this particular bill and the Dash 1 amendments. 2 years ago, for the past 2 years, I should say, I have lobbied vigorously against this legislation. Yet, thanks to the language that we now find in the Dash 1 amendments, Express Scripts is very pleased to not only to support this bill, in part because it does, in fact, eliminate barriers that were created in prior versions of this bill. Senate Bill 147 ensures that information as to the product dispensed is entered into the patient's electronic medical record as soon as it's dispensed, with no added burden or responsibility on the part of the pharmacist. Practically speaking, there is no change to the current practice of pharmacy. The vast majority of pharmacies and prescribers in this country use e-prescribing now. 98% of retail pharmacy, 96% of independent pharmacies, and 80% of prescribers are using e-prescribing technology. These technologies all link up through an entity called SureScripts. So SureScripts, no matter what software prescriber A is using and pharmacy B is using, it all links up through SureScripts. So when the prescriber enters that information, says, here's what I want dispensed, as soon as the pharmacist dispenses whatever drug, that all that information goes into the patient electronic medical record in real time. In real time, prescribers will have access to information as to exactly what was dispensed. biologic, non-biologic, doesn't matter. That's the way the system works currently. This information is immediately and readily available and accessible by prescribers. A prescriber simply sends a record request in saying, I want a medical record for Senator Mona Sanderson, and within seconds we'll get a 12 to 24 month record of every prescription that has been filled for you. And with that, so for those reasons, we believe Senate Bill 147 and the communication language contained within provides ready access for prescribers and patients and protections for both. And for those reasons, we request your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. And then the last panel, President Courtney can hear, this is our last panel of three people. You can come on down. Is Marl Farsi, Liz, Hochin, and Eric Linter.
So then we all sit down and try and figure out who goes first.
Oh. Marvel's going first.
I can go first.
Okay.
Sorry. Honorable Chairwoman Modest Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Maral Farsi. I represent CVS Health. We're a national health care provider through our retail pharmacies and our retail clinics. However, in the state of Oregon, we practice as a pharmacy benefit manager, and we provide our services to health plan clients that cover Medicaid patients and patients through the employer benefits. We offer access to our mail and specialty pharmacies, as well as prescription drug utilization management. So we realize the impact of this bill both as a payer and as a pharmacy, and we ask for your opposition at this time. We do feel that notification is completely unnecessary and has already been considered and addressed by the FDA. The federal definition of interchangeability specifically states that these are drugs that can be substituted, and I'm quoting, without the intervention of a healthcare provider who prescribed the reference product. Of course, that brings us to the issue of information availability to the provider. You just heard from a proponent that stated that the effort required for notification is minimal. This is highly inaccurate. I have submitted for today's hearing a statement from the entity SureScripts that has clearly stated that this information is not necessarily readily available to all providers by logging into a website and discovering it through some kind of a portal. If you look at the bottom of the first page on this document, it says that to the question, does SureScripts have a medication history portal on their website making this data available to all prescribers? No, this has never been the case. SureScripts does not have a medication history portal on its website. We certainly would like to see the expansion of interoperable medical records in the state that would allow such a convenient sharing of information to support patient-centered healthcare model. But as that capability grows, pharmacies would still be tasked with determining whether a provider has the capability to access this information. So this literally means they have to figure out if a provider can get access to this information electronically before they make it available electronically or via fax, phone, etc. This takes our pharmacists away from meaningful work they can be doing in delivering patient care and counseling. The bill also provides no clarity on what will be done with the information about interchange or substitution once the provider receives the notification and whether they need to confirm receipt of such information. As you have correctly pointed out, the option for writing a dispense as written is available, but we are concerned that in order to minimize the liability, that we will start seeing dispense as written on every prescription. This notification, this creation of this requirement, it has not been requested by a, I apologize. We feel that it's meant to hamper substitutions for interchangeable products that have been, again, fully vetted by the FDA that have to go through clinical trials to be determined interchangeable.
Thank you.
The people of this state who are obviously dealing with incredibly serious chronic health care conditions, I feel have been dealt a sense of doubt in what these drugs can do and provide. And the FDA, I believe, is doing their due diligence. Is that? I apologize if I've gone too long.
That's all right. No, you've got your point across. Thank you so much.
Senator Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lise Houch, and I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I believe my testimony is posted on the OLIS, is that correct? Okay, so in the interest of time, if with your permission, I'd like to just read through this very quickly. NACDS opposes Senate Bill 147 in its current form, which requires pharmacists or the pharmacist or their designee to notify the prescriber when a biological product is dispensed, which includes any future approved interchangeable biosimilars. The 2010 law, this is a federal law, expressly states that a pharmacist or other dispenser may substitute an interchangeable biological product for the reference product without consulting the prescriber, and Mauro mentioned this. This is important because substitutability helps spur the growth of the generic drug industry at an earlier time and is similarly essential to help foster competition in the biological drug market. Ultimately, such competition will spur innovation, improve consumer choice, and drive down medical costs. The high standards for approval of biosimilar and interchangeable products means that patients and health professionals can be assured that when those products go to market, they will meet the standards of safety, efficacy, and high quality that everyone expects and counts on. Efforts to undermine trust in these products are worrisome and represent a disservice to patients who could benefit from these lower-cost treatments. Unfortunately, full electronic medical records do not currently exist. If prescribers are adamant on being notified when an interchangeable has been dispensed, when substitution has been permitted by the prescriber, we would ask that the prescriber indicate, in quotes, notification of interchangeable, end quotes, or NOI on the prescription. This could be done electronically, handwritten. We don't need to go into the details, but I want to make sure it could be with any transmission of any kind of prescription. We respectfully request that either the original bill be amended or be set aside and let the notification requirement on interchangeable sunset as we agreed to in the original law, which was passed several years ago. Thank you so much for having me today.
Hello, my name is Eric Lintner. I'm a pharmacist licensed in Oregon for 30-some-odd years. I work for Consonus Long-Term Care Pharmacy, and I represent the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, which is a joint effort of two different associations representing all different practices of pharmacy in Oregon. And we've heard a lot of really good testimony today, and I think we all agree that these are expensive drugs, these are very important drugs, and we have an opportunity for people to save some money when biosimilars become available. We've also heard a lot of testimony that was, frankly, peripheral issues that aren't addressed by this bill. The biosimilars will be on the market regardless of what this bill does. Electronic medical records don't share that information regardless of what this bill does. Okay, so it's not all information relative to the bill. What I will tell you is that the net effect is that pharmacists will have an extra burden. Okay, and it will be more difficult for biosimilars to get to the people that need them most. Those are the net effects. Okay, now, do you want to place a burden on a pharmacist? Possibly. I hope not. I think we are asked to do a lot of things that other people don't want to do until they get dumped on us. That happens a lot. I think the physicians do have a perfectly adequate availability to determine ahead of time what will get dispensed. And I think we've heard that today. Okay, so those things are in place. The bill is unnecessary. It's unprecedented in the fact that it takes away from the pharmacist some of our abilities and things that we've been trained to do.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. This has been a very good hearing, and I really think that this is a topic not new to this committee. We've had it last year, so I thank everyone who came for Senate Bill 147, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147. Is Senator Courtney here?
you could suspend the rules to reopen work sessions so I could vote on the two I missed.
Okay. All right, I'm going to open.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended to allow me to vote on Senate Bill 297 and Senate Bill 144.
Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules to allow him to vote on Senate Bill 279 and Senate Bill 144. Mm-hmm. Is there any objection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Senator Shields and I object.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about it either.
I don't know.
Point of order, Madam Chair. Can one make a motion to allow themselves to vote on a bill?
Absolutely.
And I guess I would ask the good senator whether he was out because he was smoking or because of business.
I was talking about a bill that's up next Monday in this committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
All right, I will withdraw my objection.
Okay, fine. All right. This time only.
Me too.
So, how do you vote on Senate Bill 279?
I vote yes.
How do you vote on Senate Bill 144?
Oh, yes.
All right. So noted for the record, and I'll close the work session, and I'm going to, where are we with, should I go ahead with Senate Bill 7 or not? Okay. So let's start. We will interrupt and go to Senate Courtney when he comes in, but I'm going to open a, who do we have on Senate Bill 7 to, how many do we have to testify? Three, okay, so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 7. And can you look out just to see? He might be in a meeting. Well, maybe I should go.
Go ahead and read it, and then they can.
Okay. Yeah. We'll go ahead, and she will introduce it. When they come in, we'll stop our hearing on our palliative care bill. When they come in, let them testify, and then we'll go back to palliative care. Okay. Oh. So I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 7.
Senate Bill 7 directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to procure or supervise the procurement of Oregon Health Authority's information technology. There's no revenue impact, and no fiscal statement has been issued.
Great. I just got a text. He's coming now. So we'll call up Diane Lancaster, Kurt Rose. Come very slowly, and we will let Senator Courtney come in.
Here he is.
I have just called you to the front. Yeah. Would you like other people to come up here with you?
A whole room to come up.
We try to wire.
It's your show.
Chair Montesanderson and Vice Chair Cruz members. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator from District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. And I live in Salem. I've come here today to ask for support for Senate Bill 7. Which in effect is aiding and abetting Senate Bill 1, which is already moved from this committee as well as off the floor, and I believe has made its way all the way to the governor's desk. While working on fixing the Cover Oregon problem, crisis, however you want to describe it, we found that some other controversial technological contracts were actually through the Oregon Health Authority's contracting exemptions. And we want to close these exemptions. This bill requires that the Oregon Health Authority contract under the Public Contracting Code and under the supervision of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. And hopefully this will go a long way to ensure more oversight and accountability. I'm going to stop there because it's a very technical bill, and that is why I'm joined by Lori Freeman from Legislative Council to go into the details as well as others. So it's just a general statement. We're trying to complete the task of the overhaul, modification, remodeling of Cover Oregon. It's my understanding that we could not do it just one bill. We need two bills to do this. So this involves the contracting authority of the Oregon Health Authority. So that is why I have brought this bill to this esteemed and august committee, which has worked so hard on this issue.
Thank you. Questions?
Let's hear from Lori first, because I'm a little confused here.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Office of Legislative Counsel, and I brought Sean Brennan with me because he's actually our public contracting guru. But what happened was this had to be a separate bill because it wouldn't have fit in the relating clause of Senate Bill 1 because that was relating to the health insurance exchange, and this has to do with the Oregon Health Authority. But basically the idea is to clamp down on some of the sort of unbridled discretion that OHA had in entering into IT contracts. Now, there's a lot of sections where they have the authority to go forth and procure without DAS in a number of areas, and we didn't touch all of them. We just narrowed it down to a few areas, mainly the IT contracts, and some areas where they think they didn't even need their independent authority.
Thank you. Now, do you understand?
Well, I mean, Madam Chair, the first thing, because it's dealing with maintaining and constructing highways, bridges, and other transportation facilities, and then I was having a little bit of trouble connecting that to OHA.
Senator Monis-Anderson, Senator Cruz, actually, the only real substantive change in that is on page 2. Wait a minute. Am I on the right page? No, I'm not. Page 3, line 15. Okay. The others are just sort of form and style changes that we made.
Okay.
But this takes out their exception for IT contracts.
As long as we rein them in from doing the things they have done, I'm perfectly fine with this. So.
Great. Thank you. Are there other questions? Great. We only have two more people to...
Thank you.
Well, Sean isn't going to talk unless we had a question, right? All right. Diane Lancaster and Kurt Rhodes.
Thank you, Ms. President.
Mr. President. Thank you.
You should have asked me questions that didn't, so I'm deeply hurt.
No, it's because you did such an excellent job explaining that we didn't need to ask you any questions.
The whole time.
No, that is so not true, Mr. President. I was reading the text of the bill, sir.
I thought we weren't supposed to ask him questions on the days he wore his blue shoes. So.
Oh, is that the rule?
Yeah, that's
the
rule.
Thank you for clarifying, okay. Senator. That's okay. Very helpful.
All right.
Yes, love Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Diane Lancaster, and I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Senate Bill 7 provides a guiding policy and an approach to put the Oregon Health Authority's technology contracting needs appropriately under DAS procurement and IT acquisition oversight and guidance. Representatives of the two agencies have reached an understanding, and we are collaborating on the issues, including transition planning, so that there will be a seamless transition of service. Today, we are offering a proposed conceptual amendment that would avoid some further unintended consequences while still meeting the full policy goal of the bill. That proposed conceptual amendment is available electronically and has been provided to Legislative Council as well, and, of course, to Senator Courtney's office. Certainly, you've already heard that the first section, while it is lengthy and has many changes of minor significance, does repeal the basic exemption that Oregon Health Authority had enjoyed from DAS exclusive authority over information technology contracts. We are going to offer that Section 2 amends the OHA director's authority to contract for services, and we have inserted some extra language in there to recognize DAS authority over any information technology contracts in that particular section of law. And as you can tell, there are different sections of law. Some of them are the 279 procurement code. Others are in the Chapter 413 of the Oregon Health Authority's own statutes. Section 3 is another piece of that, which amends, the director's authority in certain special services, including certain participations in organizations. Section 4 does continue that theme of removing a few very special circumstances where public procurement code does not apply, and the Oregon Health Authority does need to obtain services for cultural competency education, certain gambling addiction services, and research on controlled substance abuse. So this amendment, again, is to propose certain changes to the current bill and hopefully to improve it to be clear for everyone concerned. I have with me Mr. Kirk Rhodes from the Oregon Health Authority Procurement Office, and I'll let Kirk respond.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Kirk Rhodes. I'm the Director of Office of Contracts and Procurement and the Procurement Officer for DHS and OHA Home Care Commission. And we began a dialogue with the introduction of several of the bills that dealt with this topic some time ago with DAS. And DAS has been very accommodating and helpful in moving through this process. We had a meeting most recently in February with senior members of OHA, DOJ, and DAS, and we discussed the proposed changes that are in this amendment. We believe it's a good amendment. We believe that it will continue to provide the contracting instruments and authority for OHA to continue to serve the neediest amongst us.
Have you talked with I believe it's Senator Courtney about, and is he amenable to these proposed amendments?
Chairman Sanderson, I have not personally spoken with Senator Courtney, but our legislative manager, Barry Pack, who is our deputy director, has been in contact with the senator's office. As you may understand, there were three, I think, legislative bills that were introduced that would address this specific issue, and there has been conversation about which bill would be the appropriate bill to use. And now come a certain amount of what we would like to see to just finalize it. And so I believe that Senator Courtney and his office have been fully informed of our desire to offer these.
It would be nice if you would send your proposed language through Zena.
Yes.
Who will then get it down to Lori. And
Thank
then
you.
Once it comes out, we will share that with Senator Courtney's office. If everyone's on board, then we can move the bill.
Thank you, ma'am.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Our pleasure.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 608. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 608 establishes a 9-member palliative care and quality of life interdisciplinary action council in the Oregon Health Authority. It establishes the palliative care consumer and professional information education program. It requires health facilities to establish a system for identifying patients or residents that could benefit from palliative care. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal statement has been issued.
Okay, we have several people. Is there someone who wants to start out? Okay.
Madam Chair, I think looking at the sponsor list of this bill, I think it's going to have a pretty good chance of getting out of this committee.
Yes and maybe yes, Senator. I don't know. Some of our other colleagues might object. And, you know, I mean, God forbid that we should actually have a bipartisan bill or something.
Hello, committee members. For the record, my name is Troy Rayburn. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'm here today to encourage your support for Senate Bill 608 and say thank you for hearing the bill today. We have a number of people testifying in support of the bill, so you'll hear from a couple different panels, but I'll start by introducing the bill. As part of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network's 2015 legislative agenda, we are endorsing Senate Bill 608 that improves the quality and delivery of palliative care services in Oregon by convening an interdisciplinary council to work through a host of questions and issues regarding palliative care. You may ask, why palliative care? Palliative care is specialized medical care that focuses on providing patients with relief from the symptoms of pain and stress associated with serious illnesses. It provides a coordinated and team-based approach among medical professionals to help ensure the patient's needs are met throughout the treatment and survivorship. It gives patients and their families a voice in realizing their treatment goals and is appropriate at any age and any stage of a serious illness. It can be applied to both inpatient and outpatient services. You may also be asking, why palliative care? People want palliative care. Recent public opinion research shows that once informed about palliative care, 92% of consumers say these services should be available for seriously ill patients and their families. Palliative care is also supported, by an overwhelming majority of doctors, as you will hear momentarily. It is also important to note that quality care leads to cost reduction. Recent studies indicate that by closely matching treatments to the patient's goals, improving their quality of life, palliative care can provide substantial cost reduction. It reduces long lengths of hospital stay, high costs per day, and high utilization of critical care and other hospital resources. In addition, in any organization, communication barriers develop as professionals go about their busy schedules. People become preoccupied with their multiple responsibilities and forget to communicate and coordinate needed services in the most efficient manner. The Interdisciplinary Council will work to identify and work through these type of issues to prevent patients and their caregivers from receiving the best services possible. The council will further raise awareness, availability, and utilization of palliative care services. Senate Bill 608 further specializes council membership, the purpose and responsibilities of the council, number of meetings 2 year, and I believe it says two approximately per year, and the meeting and administrative requirements. ACS CAN passed the same legislation in 5 other states, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maryland, with no or very little fiscal impact. The only expenses these 5 states incurred are printing costs, mileage charges for council members to travel to and from and to the couple of meetings, and costs for a catered lunch. Our testimonial panels today will highlight the experiences of both cancer patients and healthcare professionals, including Dr. Mavity from St. Charles Hospital in Bend, and Dr. Eric Fromey and Susan Headland from OHSU. The committee should also be in receipt, I believe, of letters of testimonial support from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Associations, the National Association of Social Workers, and I believe you'll hear from a number of supportive coalition members as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Laura Mavity, and I'm the Clinical Director of the Advanced Illness Management Palliative Care Program at St. Charles Health System, and I'm a practicing palliative medicine physician. I'm testifying today at the request of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. While palliative care can provide significant improvements in quality of life for patients and families with advanced illnesses, the challenges associated with implementing high-quality palliative care programs are very significant. These challenges are especially difficult for smaller health systems and hospitals in more rural Oregon communities, making it much harder for patients and families in these areas to access palliative care services. St. Charles Health System is based in Central Oregon, and we are the largest healthcare system east of the Cascades. Therefore, our catchment area goes all the way up to the Tri-Cities area, all the way east to the Idaho border, all the way south to California-Nevada borders. So as you can see, this large encompassing area is predominantly rural. St. Charles has 4 hospitals in its system. St. Charles Bend is our largest hospital, but we also have St. Charles Medical Center in Redmond, which is a designated rural hospital, and we also have Pioneer Memorial Hospital in Prineville, as well as St. Charles Madras in Madras, which are 2 critical access hospitals in very small rural communities. Our palliative care services at St. Charles began in 2009 formally, and as is true of many palliative care programs around the country, we began as an inpatient palliative care service at the hospital in Bend.
In our first year, we saw 234 palliative care patients, and these were provided by one part-time palliative care physician at the hospital in Bend. With rapid growth and support from both grant funds as well as St. Charles Health System, our team this year will see almost 1,000 patients in both the inpatient and outpatient settings throughout Central Oregon, and we foresee more growth in the near future. St. Charles Health System has wholeheartedly supported this development due to the demonstrated benefits that Troy mentioned, which are noted improving quality of care for patients and their families struggling with advanced illness. They have increased satisfaction with their health care. They have improved symptom management, and they get improved efficiency and more appropriate resource utilization for their health care by ensuring that the health care provided to them is delivered per their wishes and per their goals. By ensuring that the health care delivered to these patients is exactly what they want, this helps us to avoid non-beneficial and costly procedures and tests that do not meet those patients' goals. With our limited staffing and high demand in the large area we serve, we struggle with how to provide palliative care access to patients in more rural communities. In fact, on my way to this meeting today, I was on the phone with my team in Bend trying to figure out how we were going to get a person out to Prineville to see a patient in desperate need of urgent palliative care services today. Especially for hospitals whose palliative care programs are still developing like ours, Senate Bill 608 provides an important opportunity to take an in-depth look at barriers to palliative care within our state. The Interdisciplinary Advisory Council that is established will include a broad, diverse range of professionals who will be able to tackle some of the field's most tough issues. Additionally, this group will be an important forum for sharing best practices, something that will particularly benefit hospitals like ours that are outside of the Portland metro area. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify for this bill, and I very much hope that you'll feel comfortable supporting this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Chair Mona Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Kate Graven, and I want to thank you very much for having me here today to tell you a little bit of my family's story. I'm a volunteer with the American Cancer Society, and I'm a member of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and a very proud resident of Dallas, Oregon for 34 years. In 2004, my wonderful dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. We were not surprised. He started smoking young, and he battled smoking addiction his entire life. When he met with the doctors to talk about treatment options, he made a decision without the benefit of palliative care or discussion of quality of life to have surgery. When the surgeon went in to do the surgery, he found that my dad's lung was too severely damaged to remove the spot, and he removed his lung, half of it, the lower lobe. And the surgeon left on a scheduled vacation. What followed was a pretty horrifying experience for us. We didn't have the support of a palliative care team, and he was in and out of ICU for about a month and a half. Many different doctors were involved in his care, and we got quite conflicting information often. And we were asked to make medical decisions about his treatment that we were not equipped to make. When a serious infection occurred, my dad spent the last 2 weeks of his life in ICU with a tracheotomy, in a drug-induced coma, on dialysis, and not able to communicate with us at all. We're still not really sure what all occurred during that time. It was very confusing for us. And on July 3rd, when he passed away, we had little warning that that was going to be the end result. And Dad's journey left my family with lots of regrets and a lot of what-ifs. And I can't help believing in my heart that if palliative care had been available at that time and we had engaged it, that this would have been a very different story. What if the palliative care team had talked to him about his initial treatment decision and talked about the quality of life and what might have followed that kind of surgery? Maybe he'd have chosen something else. We don't know. What if after the surgery, when the doctor left on vacation, there would have been a group of people already in place who would have stepped in and coordinated the doctor's care of my dad and provided information to our family that helped us understand what was going on. What if counselors or spiritual advisors, support nurses had been available to my family to help us navigate this illness? I can't help believing that there may have been like even a different outcome had that been true. You have the ability today to change this story for the families in the state of Oregon who have critically ill family members. And I would ask you, please, please, to support this bill to make sure that they don't go through this. Envision, if you will, reviewing my father's illness and death and knowing that every decision that was made with a group of professionals with my dad's quality of life at their heart. Imagine the peace that would bring my family. Please support this bill. Thank you.
It took a lot of courage for you to come, and thank you so much. I think all of us have tears in our
harder
eyes.
Harder than it. Sorry.
So thank you very, very much.
Thanks. That must be why you have Kleenex.
It is. And how about a glass of water, too?
That would be nice, too.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure you'd had a different outcome, but you'd had a better quality getting there. And I had my first conversation on this subject with John Kitzhaber in 1999.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And, you are old.
And it's almost embarrassing that we haven't done more in this field in the intervening years. Other things kept popping up, but, you know, I mean, it's not just having the services you provide. This also talks about a culture change in the medical community itself, okay? Because you were dealing with a physician that was trying to fix something that he probably couldn't fix, okay? But that's what doctors do, is they try to fix things. And I'm very grateful that we are making this step, and I'm because it's not just what we're telling patients and how they're able to react to these things, but it's also allowing doctors to admit from time to time that they can't fix everything. So I think this is a good step. I'm glad to see this bill here.
Thank you, sir.
Any other comments? Yes, Senator Steiner here.
I just want to, first of all, thank all of you and really emphasize one point that's been made. People often confuse palliative care and hospice, and they are not the same.
Right.
Everybody deserves palliative care. Many people need hospice at the end of their lives, but palliative care is for any time when you need, let's remember the root of the word, palliation, which means to help or to alleviate symptoms and to provide for the palliation that comes from really knowing that somebody is looking out for you first, right? And it's very important for people to understand that this bill is designed to make sure that we are treating people and their families as whole beings and not as a disease or as a collection of symptoms, but rather as whole people. And the help that palliative care can bring includes not just alleviation of physical symptoms, but the emotional and spiritual support that so many people need when they're going through a tough time and ways to engage families in these difficult times. And that's why I'm so proud to see every single member of this committee as one of the sponsors of this bill, because we see this and we understand it and we will get this bill moving forward because we all believe in it. And it's just common sense. So thank you. We know how hard it is to come and testify about this stuff. We know how hard it is to tell these really painful stories. But they are so important.
Put it in the middle.
And we totally get it. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank
I'm
you.
Sure I learned something. I didn't know the definition of palliation until just now. So thanks for
I live to serve.
Susan
Senator.
Headland and Dr. Eric Frum and Cody McLaughlin.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's try to keep the comments to 3 minutes. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for the privilege to come and testify on behalf of this bill. For the record, my name is Susan Headland, and I'm a social worker. I'm the manager for the Patient and Family Support Services for the Knight Cancer Institute at OHSU. I also supervise the social workers who work in our outpatient palliative care oncology clinic. OHSU had one of the first inpatient palliative care teams in Oregon called the Comfort Care Team, founded in 1995. And I had the privilege of being a social worker on that team. So evidently, I'm older than Senator Cruz. after that, I worked in the community directing a home-based palliative care team in partnership with Care Oregon and helped to establish a palliative care program in a community oncology practice before returning to OHSU. I was involved in helping to plan for Oregon's first hospice programs many years ago at the beginning of my career. And because the focus of my work has been oncology, I started to increasingly recognize a disconnect between hospice and our cancer patients who are surviving much longer and who were reluctant to give up active treatment to access hospice's support services, which is mandated by many hospices. I kept thinking that so many of our patients could benefit from the physical, psychological, social, and spiritual support that hospice offered, yet to give up life-extending treatment for many of those patients was not something that they wanted to do until death was more imminent. Palliative care, as you have noted, has emerged as an important way of providing care that focuses on aggressive symptom management, intense psychosocial and spiritual support, and it also attends to the distress of ill patients and their loved ones, addressing caregiver burden, while also attempting to assure that quality of life and a patient's preferences are understood. As social workers, we attempt to intervene with our patients and families to offer help and support through counseling, guidance with decision-making, coordination of care. In our outpatient oncology care program, which has been underway for exactly 1 year, 316 patients were seen, and 198, or greater than 60% of them, were seen by our social workers. It speaks to the complexity of decision-making, planning, and attention to more than the medical concerns, and as Senator Steiner acknowledged, it's really about care for the whole person and their families. Social work involvement with these issues can also ensure that the doctors and the nurse practitioners who we work with can do what they do best, which is to attend to the medical and physical needs of the patients. Despite enormous growth in palliative care and recognition of the importance of social workers' involvement, there continues to be challenges that are unique to social workers. One of the biggest barriers is that at present, there's no reimbursement for social workers by insurers for their work in palliative care. The physicians and nurse practitioner visits are reimbursable, but not the social workers' time. And that makes it difficult to make a funding case for administrators in the hospital for these physicians. And it also creates reluctance on the part of home-based palliative and hospice programs to add the palliative care services with an entire psychosocial team. As you might imagine, some of the concerns that social workers discuss with patients and their loved ones are challenging ones. How will my family manage over the course of my illness? What gives my life meaning? How will we manage all of this financially if I'm no longer able to work? How can I talk to my children about my impending death? These are conversations that take time. Being able to be reimbursed for a clinical social worker's palliative care interventions would be quite helpful. And research, again, suggests that patients who receive outpatient palliative care earlier in their cancer experience have better quality of life, fewer depressive symptoms, and in some cases actually live longer. Also leads to better patient family caregiver outcomes and can lead to more appropriate referral to and use of hospice and reduced use of futile intensive care. I really believe that Senate Bill 608 offers an important venue for best practices and problem solving, and especially significant, it really requires that social workers be included in this group. It takes a village. Dr. Frome and I talk about that a lot. But I think that the lens that my profession can bring to palliative care is a unique one. And most importantly, it takes a full interdisciplinary team to better assist the people at the heart of this whole story, which are our patients and their loved ones. I ask the committee to demonstrate its commitment, but I think we're singing to the choir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. For the record, my name is Eric Fromey, and in 2002, I became Oregon's first fellowship-trained palliative care physician, and I'm the medical director for palliative care service at OHSU, and am testifying because of Troy from the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network asked me to. And so, you know, when I read the bill, I didn't imagine that I would see all the sponsors of the bill sitting in front of me. So I'm going to tailor my remarks a little bit based on that lack of recognition when I prepared them. So I don't think I need to tell you all of the things that I thought that I needed to tell you. But let me tell you why I think your bill is important from my standpoint. So I think Troy quoted the number that 92% of Oregonians, when they knew what palliative care was, said that they thought it was something that was really important and should be available to everybody. So what he didn't say is that only 32% of those people actually reported knowing what palliative care is. So if 92% of people thinks it's important when they know what it is, but they don't know what it is, they're not going to ask for it. So that's a problem. So I think this bill could help with that, because what it starts to do in my mind is it starts to frame experiences like what Kay was talking about as a public health problem. And that really, I think people for the longest time, that these things have been happening in hospitals all over the place, and people just think that they're inevitable. And they don't understand that actually there's a lot of things that have to come together in order for that to happen, and that at each step along the way there are opportunities to intervene. And Senator Cruz talked about the necessity of changing the culture in healthcare, and I think that's really important, because it's interesting. Patients and families are pretty interested in palliative care when they hear what it is. The obstacles that I encounter are more doctors and health professionals who think they know what palliative care is, but they're actually misinformed. And I get it's sort of like guilt by association. So do I take care of very sick people, many of whom die? Yes, I do, but so does every person that I work with in the NIH Cancer Institute. But palliative care is not about dying. It's about living for as long as you can and the best way that you can. Palliative care is about quality of life. And it's a problem that people don't know what palliative care is. But that's changing, right? So it's weird to say this, but the number one best-selling book in the country on the New York Times list is Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. And it's number one on the list. You can look it up. So and everybody that I bump into has some connection to this book. Their family members reading it. They saw it on Frontline. If you have not, I recommend that every human being read this book. It is incredibly important. Or watch the show on Frontline. So I was at a conference. We were both at this conference, and he's their keynote speaker. And somebody asked him, you know, what is the most surprising thing to you about palliative care, Dr. Gawande? And he said, why aren't people listening to you? He said, why is that? And on the way out, I read a little, there's this poster board that people could write comments on, and somebody said, why do we need a surgeon, or do we really need a surgeon to tell us why what we do matters? And my comment was, yeah, we sure, apparently we really do. You know, maybe not to us, but we needed someone to tell everybody else why what we do is important, because what we do is incredibly important. You know, we interface with people like Kay every single day, and we try to wade into that difficult situation, and we try to make it better by any means possible. And we do that by we focus what's the most important thing, and we try to put that right at the center of care. But as has been alluded to, there's not enough of us, and there will never be enough of us to take care of every single person who needs us in this state. The broader you make palliative care, the less likely it is that there's going to be a specialist trained, and the further you get out, the less care is driven by specialty and specially trained consult teams. So the other thing that is important about this bill is the education of non-palliative care health professionals. And I can say, so since 2002, I have presented half or full day conferences on palliative care to 3,669 different health professionals around Oregon. Well, some of them are repeat customers, but so that's like 18,000 person hours of palliative care education. But those are only, in order to get that education, you have to want that education. You have to come to my conference and see. And it's not those people that I'm worried about. It's everybody else. So you frame this as a public health problem. You start to get people doing what we are now calling primary palliative care. And I think that's where the action is here. Mm-hmm. Primary palliative care is the care that everybody who's trained as a health professional can provide and does provide. Whenever they just listen to the patient, whenever they ask them, what's going on? What is your experience? You know, what is that like for you? What are you hoping to happen here? What are you afraid of? How can we put these things at the center of your plan of care so that we don't, in the attempt to save the patient, actually accidentally increase the suffering for the patient and the family and, by the way, the cost of the health system?
Thank you.
So thank you very much for sponsoring this bill. I really personally appreciate it.
Comment. Thank you very much. Now, is Cody McLaughlin here? I guess not. Jessica Adamson, B.J. Kavnar, John Bartholomew, and Tom Holt at the end.
I think Mr. Kavnar is going to get our frequent flyer award. Not that we mind hearing from you, Mr. Kavnar. It's just very funny.
It's always a pleasure, Senator. Being as I've already, I will start. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavnar. I serve as Executive Director of 1 and 4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Healthcare Collaborative in Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you very much for this bill. My own experience with palliative care is more than 30 years old. 30 years ago. And I'm not old. And it was during the initial HIV/AIDS crisis when those of us who were being impacted by the loss of friends, neighbors, loved ones created forms of what we now consider palliative care. We would support not only those of us who were living with illness and dying from illness, but also those in the community as well. I would ask that we look to those examples as we move forward. There are some wonderful examples of things that we've done in the past which are very easily replicable and very inexpensive. My own parents, I lost both my parents to cancer. My father did not choose palliative care. My mother, in the end, did. And her palliative care mostly took place in hospice in Baltimore. And it was an incredible experience. I understand clearly that palliative care does not equal hospice, but in this case, the two were synonymous. And the care that was provided my mother to ease her physical pain, and in many ways her psychological pain, the when she was still able to recognize that her loved ones were around her and were okay and were being, you know, taken care of as well, and that she was safe, it just allowed all of us to be that much more comfortable with her passing. As difficult as it was, we were able to be present and to show love and to support. I do want to add that in addition to providing palliative care as an ongoing issue for cancer patients, and that we look to all patients who are living with chronic health conditions. And one of the most simple things that is often the most difficult is access to adequate pain management for patients who are living with pain conditions as a result of their illness. Far too often I hear stories about patients who are unable to get adequate levels of pain medicine because providers are concerned about abuse potential. Providers are concerned, of course, about their own license coming into question. And this is something that we've got to be able to start addressing now as we move forward. Pain is a very individual thing, and treatment for pain is equally an individual thing. And we just completely support this work, and thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I am John Bartholomew, the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. We wholeheartedly support this legislation. Palliative care is something that many of our members utilize at some point. But I just wanted to share a little bit from the last 3 years when I was working at the Alzheimer's Association and the experience that I had there. Because people with Alzheimer's disease can live for many years, but there is no known cure or even a way to slow the disease, and it's a progressive disease. And they are obviously great candidates for the use of palliative care in a number of ways. And part of it is that they suffer from isolation and depression, which also often impacts their behaviors, which impact their families. And I saw firsthand the impact of social engagement programs, such as music and art programs, that really helped a lot of people in many ways who were living with Alzheimer's disease. Some cases, these people were there because a palliative care team suggested that they participate in this program. In other cases, they came to the program because they found out about it through other ways. But palliative care teams did recommend folks to these programs. These programs led to improvements in their behavior, which led to less stress for their caregivers and absolutely improved their quality of life. I saw all too many people participate in these programs for a couple of years and pass away, and but they were living a great life at the end. And if we can see more people be able to do that, that'll be a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We are wildly enthusiastic about this bill, and one of the things that I came to learn when I joined Providence was the kind of driving mission of our caregivers is a saying around know me, care for me, ease my way. That's really what we strive to do for each and every one of our patients. And palliative care is really at the heart of that. It's about understanding and knowing what our patients need and want, what their families need and want. It's about caring for them in a way that supports those values. And it's about easing their way through really difficult and serious illnesses. We could not be more supportive of this bill and of the work to educate the public, to raise the awareness of clinicians in palliative care. As a system, we have brought in one of the national experts, Dr. Ira Byock, to build out palliative care as a system-wide initiative and make sure that in all of our facilities, we're able to offer top-notch care and include palliative care as a component of that. It is part of everything that we do. This is more than, as Senator Hayward aptly noted, is more than hospice. So we are pleased to support this bill, and we appreciate the American Cancer Society for bringing it forward. One of the things is our clinicians have looked at this bill and the tremendous benefits that it will bring. We want to make sure that in the kind of last section of the bill, it talks about things that hospital facilities and health facilities will be doing. We appreciate in conversations with the American Cancer Society willingness to talk about adding some language about primary care provider engagement in placing in facilities, because this really is about a larger picture of palliative care. It should be about more than just getting to a place in a facility where we're making a transition into palliative care, but really a whole patient-centered primary care home concept of doing that. So we appreciate their willingness to engage in that conversation, and again, very much appreciate them bringing forward this legislation.
Just one quick question. If you will draft maybe some language that in conjunction with the Cancer Society, make sure, well, we can get the language and then make sure that the proponents are okay with it, then we would be ready for a fiscal revenue statement. Mm. But okay. Do you pay for palliative care? I mean, where's the funding for palliative care in Providence system?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Cruz, I want to make sure that I answer that question correctly. So I know that we make investments in palliative care and that there are different payers that that do pay for that. It is an above the line kind of embedded service in Medicaid. So that is something not all of the states that Providence operates in pay for palliative care as part of the Medicaid program. We do in Oregon, which I think puts us again at the forefront of care. I will find out additional information for you and get back to you.
Because that's probably something that we're going to need to look at.
Yeah.
How that's, unless yep. systems can absorb the cost. Okay.
We do find that patients who choose palliative care, for whom that is offered, and they choose to engage and enroll and are part of that, we find that they not only live longer, but their quality of life is better. The patient satisfaction, the family satisfaction is much, much better when they're going through a prolonged illness, and the outcomes are better as a result of palliative care.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Steiner Hayward.
Let's get this right. I want a complete product coming out of this committee.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. I completely agree with Senator Cruz, and obviously as a primary care physician, I'm delighted to have that language inserted, and I apologize for not catching it earlier. I think, you know, several people have alluded to this, but you talk about the cost of this. I firmly believe that ultimately palliative medicine, first and foremost, does exactly what Ms. Adams and everybody else has said. It improves quality of life. It improves length of life. It improves patient satisfaction, all of which should be our first and foremost mm-hmm. desired outcomes. But I also believe, it saves money. Because when people do have the opportunity to get symptoms treated properly and quickly, they do recover faster. They spend less time in the hospital. They're back on the job faster. They feel better, they engage better, they have lower risk of depression, all of which are, frankly, expensive. And so this is yet another case where doing the right thing is also the fiscally smart thing. And while, yes, the upfront investment might be a little bit higher to bring in an additional team of professionals, ultimately, the costs are dramatically lower in the long term, and I think the data are pretty crystal clear about that. So I can't really imagine that ultimately incorporating palliative care as a service under pretty much any insurance plan would really add to the bottom line. I think it would only help us meet the triple aim.
Okay.
So that's another reason I'm excited about this bill.
Thank you, Tom Holt.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. I'm delighted to be here in support of this bill. Our company embarked on a journey starting a couple of years ago to be a catalyst for the expansion of palliative care and improve its delivery. We feel very strongly that one of the most important things we could do to improve quality in healthcare is to expand the delivery of palliative care and to do it right. And we think there should be, although I really agree with and appreciate the distinction that Senator Steiner Hayward drew and Dr. Frommey drew between hospice and palliative care, we also believe very strongly that we should be paying as much attention to the end-of-life journey as we do to prenatal and early life care. Some of the things that we have done recently, we have found ourselves to be an outlier in the insurance amongst operators of insurance plans in changing our benefit structure. So we do cover things like a social worker's involvement in palliative care. And although the Medicare rules don't support it, we provide home health benefits for those who would benefit from that in palliative care. Medicare has a bizarre definition that if you can get to your mailbox, you're not homebound, so you're not eligible for home health care. And so although Medicare does not reimburse us in the Medicare Advantage program for that, we decided to bend the rules and do it anyway. And so far, our federal regulators have been good about letting us do that, and it's sparked a good conversation nationally. Similarly, some of the other benefit changes we've made, technically don't fit the essential health benefit. We're supposed to be totally cookie cutter. We had a really nice conversation with our regulators about that, and they've been very good about allowing us to bend the rules in what we think is a very positive direction. We've also made a significant investment through our foundation in helping the University of Washington get to the next level of being a center of excellence in our region in teaching new physicians as well as physicians in the field about palliative care. So we feel really good about the progress we've been able to make on a fairly rapid basis, and we think this bill is a really good step for our state in creating a forum to really look at and spread best practices and look at public policy to the extent public policy changes are needed to support palliative care.
Tom, has Medicare made any movement, or does anyone know if they've made movement toward, they cover hospice, but covering palliative care, is there talk? How about the Accountable Care Act? Is there anything in the Accountable Care Act that addresses palliative care? They talk about prevention, but...
Yeah, Chair Monis Anderson, I would have to get back to you about the ACA. To my knowledge, there isn't anything in there specifically about palliative care. I can tell you that there are conversations happening at a federal level about the Medicare rules as they apply to palliative care, and we've been encouraged by the early conversations that we've been having with CMS about that, and now others have started to join the conversation. So we all know that CMS is a slow-moving beast, but we're keeping our fingers crossed that we're going to see some positive change there in the not horribly distant future.
Yeah, Madam Chair, well, Tom, I said based on your conversations, I think CMS would have a hard time justifying coming down on you for the changes you're making. But I also think that with what we're doing with this bill, we're going to have a good jumping off place to advocate at the federal level as well.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, I couldn't agree more.
Well, that's all. I don't think there was anyone else signed up. I don't see anyone saying. So if we get the language for the amendment to Zena, we'll get it in. And if everyone's happy, we'll move it on down to Ways and Means. And colleagues, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608. If there's no problems with Senate Bill 7, we'll ask for the FSRIS on that one. Yeah. Get that one out of here, and
that's good.
With that, we're adjourned.
That's good.
With that, we're adjourned.